Yeah, Zephaniah chapter 3 and verse 8, let's pick it up there. Therefore wait you upon me, says the Eternal, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations that I may assemble the kingdoms to pour upon them my indignation, of even all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with fire of my jealousy. So he's talking about end time, assembling the kingdoms. We have this major battle that takes place, devoured with the fire of jealousy. For then will I turn to the people a pure language. So he's talking about the establishment of the millennium, verses 9 through 13. I will turn a pure language, that they may all call upon the name of the Eternal to serve him with one consent. There has been the theory within the church, and you'll still hear it from time to time. It is speculation, and I'll emphasize that, speculation that there will be only one language in the millennium, eventually. That is speculation, however. Is this saying that there's not going to be some difference of languages, allowance for language? On the one side of the argument, you have the fact that languages go back to the time of the Tower of Babel, and it was to confuse them so that they wouldn't be able to communicate in the future. In the millennium, you do want communication, so therefore, why not go back to one language? So that is the argument for one language. If that is the case, then it's going to take many generations, or at least some generations, to accomplish that. I don't think God's just going to zap a language into people's minds. It'll be a matter of teaching the language, helping them to understand it. Therefore, I suppose by the time that grandchildren are raised, then they're going to be the ones that learn it the best as they're small, and they pass it on to the next generation. And then eventually, we get to the point of one language. So it's not like Christ returns and he gives a pure language, boom, everybody just speaks Euro Japanese or whatever, you know, the language is going to be. There is an interesting article in the U.S. News and World Report, November 5th, 1990. November 5th, 1990, U.S. News and World Report. And it was entitled, "The Mother Tongue. Linguists are working back from modern speech to recreate the first language of the human race." They do believe that it came from one language, and that each language then spun off to another, so you end up with this chart. And they've got a chart here of many of these different languages, and this is a Proto-Indo-European language, and from it they've got Anatolian that comes up here into the Lydian and Palaic and the Hittite, and then up through the Hindi, Urdu, Punjabi, Sinhalese, Bengali, and I mean all these languages up on this end. We've got the Celto-Italo-Tacharan. You've got to know all these names, be able to properly spell them for the final. And it comes up here into the Latin, and from the Latin, then we've got Italian, Romanian, French, Spanish, and Portuguese. We split in Western Germanic with the English, the Flemish, the Dutch, the High German, Danish, Swedish. So, I mean, you get all these languages, and I showed you that chart. This chart, let's see if I find the original here. Where is that? I'm sure that's here somewhere. Oh, okay, here it is. If you can see it from there. This big branch here is just one small branch of all the languages on the face of the earth that come back to what they call the trunk of the tree, which is the mother tongue. So, I mean, we are talking. I think I have heard that the statement somewhere, 10,000 different languages or different parts of languages. I mean, we're talking a lot of work, just in one aspect, and that is communication in the millennium. So, you know, perhaps that's true. Perhaps we will trace all these back, and it will then go to one language. You can imagine then with the second resurrection and all those that are resurrected, if we get back to one language, then they're going to have to be taught then that language in the second resurrection. I don't know if it will be one language or, as the Hebrew also can read, a purified language. In other words, God will purify the languages that are extant. So we have two possibilities. One would be one pure language. Another possibility is purifying each of the languages. Obviously, there will be communication from Jesus Christ to all men and women, to all nations. The word pure is barar, B-A-R-A-R. B-A-R-A-R, and it means purified. Purified. We may read verse 13, the remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth. Part of the concept of a pure language is that people will speak purely. They will not use four-letter words. They will not curse. They will not use the name of Baal. We read in chapter 1, verse 5, that this is one of the things that God had against them, or verse 4, actually. We'll cut off the remnant of Baal in the name of the Chemarims from with the priests. They that swear by the Eternal and that swear by Malcolm. So using these other gods and swearing to them. So it will be purified in the fact that there will be one God. There won't be many gods for the people then to worship. In the name of the Eternal, to serve Him with one consent. So there will be unity in service. The heart will be cleansed and therefore the language will be cleansed. Isaiah 52, verse 11, talks about the heart being cleaned. Isaiah 52:11, Ezekiel 20, verse 38. Okay, on the other side of the argument, why would we believe that there would be more than one language in the millennium? Let's go to Zechariah, chapter 14. I'm sorry, chapter 8. Zechariah 8. Automatic when you're talking about the millennium to want to go to chapter 14. Zechariah 8, verse 23, thus says the Eternal of Hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold of all languages of the nations, even shall take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we heard that God is with you. So 10 men take hold of all languages of the nations. It talks in the millennium of being several languages. Now, I don't think we're going to have 10 million or 10,000 languages. I think, you know, it would be narrowed down somewhat. But it does talk about languages. Perhaps that is during the interim period as we then start to build towards one language, one communication system. So, we have several points perhaps brought out in verse 9 here as we look back on the overview of Zephaniah 3. One is that there will be a pure language so that the heart and therefore the mouth will be cleansed. They will all call on one God, the name of the Eternal, to serve Him with one consent. They're going to be consenting to one God. And there will no more be the curse of Babel. No more the curse of Babel. What is the curse of Babel? Is it languages per se? Lack of communication. Now, if you have interpreters and once you get across that barrier, I mean, we have basically broken overall the curse of Babel in that there is communication in the world. Now, there are still some places where they speak a dialect that is, you know, that they're not able really to communicate with the outside world. So there is a little bit of that left that is a difficulty. But at that particular time in the millennium, there will no more be individuals that can't communicate with others. To what degree there's one language is open for speculation. Any further questions on that? Okay. Good. Let's take the chart then that you have on Ezra, and we're just going to talk through some of that to get an overview. I figure it's a lot easier and it saves on handwriting, whatever, if I give you a handout on this. As far as who is who in the king line during the time of Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. If we go back and just review briefly, we've got the time period of the Assyrian books, and this would be anywhere from 850, So 5, 850 to the 700s. And we have Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, and Micah. And especially, we would tie in then with these Isaiah as a major prophet, and we have Hosea, Amos, and Micah then with Isaiah specifically. Jonah apparently coming earlier. Jonah, that's Joel, thank you. Shorthand, I can't read. Then to Nineveh, of the destruction that would take place, these others to Israel and to Judah. Obadiah then, of course, to Edom, with some residual effects, of course, to Judah for both Edom and Nineveh. We then come to the time of the Babylonian books. And these, we said, are what, 650 to about 605. And we have Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah. And here is basically to Judah. And we have the overlap of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Jeremiah, who was taken in 604. Ezekiel was taken in 597, if my memory serves me right. Then we had Nahum written to... let's see, we went that direction there, didn't we? Nahum is to Nineveh and to Assyria and their destruction. That would then end in 612. Nahum, therefore, written, what, about, didn't we say, anywhere from 663, and we narrowed it down to 650 and maybe even down to 620, but during that time frame. So we get two books. We get one that's written, Jonah, about 150 years before Nahum, which linked together. We have a message in the book of Micah, as well as other messages within the books of the Assyrians to Judah, that Judah better repent, or the same thing happens to them as is happening to Israel as Assyria comes on the scene. We then have these books, which we've just finished, which is the Babylonian Empire as it takes over in 612 from Nineveh, and then finally defeating them in 606 to 605, taking all of Assyria, going on to take Judah in 605, then finally to 587, the fall of Jerusalem and the temple. We find that Jeremiah is taken before the fall, and he preaches a little bit earlier than Ezekiel. Ezekiel is taken, I believe in the 597 is the date that comes to mind, about 10 years before the fall of Jerusalem. We then come to the post-exilic prophets. 587, we have a time period from the fall. If we come back here to 604, a time period of approximately, and I'm going to put a circa, 70 years, so that when we come to Cyrus the Great in 539, we have accomplished the fall of Jerusalem. The countryside has been desolate. And you can even, you know, you can go back, what is that, 609 it would be. You know, 612, the fall of Nineveh. The Assyrians have come through and taken the countryside. Babylon comes through and takes the countryside. Basically, it's decimated. So at this point, the post-exilic time, we have Cyrus as he gives the decree for syncretism. And we'll picking them up here. We have the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Well, I just want Ezra at this point. Ezra picks up with Cyrus and the story of Joshua and Zerubbabel. And these we will place at 538 with the decree to come back to the land. down till 515 when the temple was rebuilt. These are dates you should be very familiar with, or you know, basic overall dates for some of the occurrences through the Old Testament. Maybe more specific with the minor prophets as we get into this. But anyway, Joshua and Zerubbabel, who we will talk about a lot as the two individuals who were responsible for the building or the rebuilding of the temple. So they're called post-exilic. Post is after the exile. So they have been taken over to Babylon back at 587 with the fall of Jerusalem. They're really taken in different waves of captivity. 604 is one wave where Jeremiah, Daniel, I believe, was involved in this particular captivity. Ezekiel in another wave as they came through, he's taken captive and taken to Babylon. And then finally the city falls in 587. The land is basically desolate. And then we come to the time period of Ezra, the time of the Medo-Persian Empire with Cyrus the Great, Darius the Mede. So we will see Ezra talks about that. Now Ezra really recounts it, but I mean he wasn't there until many years later. So it's the book of Ezra we're talking about here. It's the people of Joshua and Zerubbabel. We have two minor prophets who preach during this time period, and those are Haggai. And Haggai is very specifically dated in the year 520. Very specific, as is Zechariah. Again, 520. And we will see the specific prophecies and when they took place, a lot of them within a couple of months of each other. So what we're going to do is try to place ourselves in Jerusalem as the people would get the message, as Zerubbabel is told, you know, you're supposed to be rebuilding the temple, and we will look at the background today, and then we'll get more specifics as we go through as far as, you know, what took place. Question? 515 it was. Well, you're going to see dates 516 to 515. It was finished. It was started in 538. Not much done on it. Let go until 520, which we'll see then the word of the Eternal comes from Haggai and Zechariah to the people in 520, telling them to rebuild, and they rebuild, and it takes them about 5 years to the year 516, 515. So this is that time period. Zechariah writes on down to 518. Let's see, 520, there's another one, 518. And I haven't looked at it in a semester, so maybe it's a little bit later also, but there are two specifically, 520 and 518. We then go to the story of Ezra. And he came back to the land in 457. And he recounts that for us. The Nehemiah comes back, and his is 444. 444. And we then conclude with Malachi. Malachi, the last book in the Old Testament as far as the King James order, probably written about 430. Maybe as late as 400, but it recounts some of the problems. There's a close tie-in with Nehemiah and some of the difficulties that Nehemiah was having. So this is the time period we're talking about now, the post-exilic time. Questions on James? Correct. Though Ezra writes about it, and sometimes in some of these names, I mean, there are certain names, John and David and other names, that there are several, you know, in any given community. The other night we had two Chris's and two Tracy's at the house. Every time we called for Tracy, well, one of the other Tracy's would answer, and, you know, you can't get things straight. Well, same thing happens sometimes in Ezra in that you get multiple Joshua's Ezra's, and they're different names. But Ezra was responsible for chronicling what had taken place. Going back to Cyrus in 539, as the book opens with that, and it covers a period of time, he does not come until 457. So the first six chapters or so is a historical account. Of course, he, we feel, was the one responsible for canonizing the Old Testament. So he may have had a hand in some of the other emendations that take place. There are other books that obviously there was, you know, when you write about Moses' death, someone else had to write that. We feel, you know, Joshua wrote that one, you know, and Moses died and whatever. You know, he wasn't responsible for writing that himself. Moses wasn't. They tried to support it by literary criticism with the use of the name of God and how that's used. That's how they try to do it. But they try to separate it and try to make it much later often than it is. Okay, then let's look at the occurrences in Ezra and Nehemiah. You get a little bit of this, or maybe you get a lot. I don't know. I haven't been in Old Testament survey in a long time, and I suppose I need to find out from Mr. Kaplan how much he covers on it. I think there's a handout or two. Is there? Oh, you did cover Ezra today. Okay. So what year did he use for the rebuilding of the temple? 516? Or did he? Okay. What about when the temple was rebuilt? Okay. That's a date I've always used, but I've also seen 516, and for the life of me, I can't remember. And part of this, frankly, when you get into 516, 515, one of the difficulties is we count time from January to January, and you get some of these crossovers, and did it end in November or December or January or whatever, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not that critical or that finite. I figure if it's within a few months, which if you say 516, 515, you go 516/5, see? And that's in those months, and on some of these situations, there is no answer. I mean, no one knows for sure, and you get different documents that say whatever. So, in the ballpark of the, you know, the month and the date. So, 515 is the date I've used before, but I know that I've seen 516. When I was in college, Jerusalem fell in 585. Since then, it fell 2 years earlier because of the turning of the earth, and we've recalculated, I don't know. Anyway, we now believe 587. For a while, it was 586. But now, I think the latest that Dr. Hayes felt is 587 with, you know, others. And, you get the experts. I mean, the experts that spend all of their lives studying this stuff will then argue back and forth it was 587 or it was 586, whatever. I mean, if they're going to argue about that, I'm quite content to say somewhere between 587 and 585, Jerusalem fell. Okay? We believe 587 now, and so that's the date we'll use in this class. James? I would say we can do it within a few months. For some of them, you can do it more specifically because there was an earthquake in such and such a year that we can figure back, and the astronomers can calculate back. Astronomers, that's a good one, right? Okay. Can figure back to that time and they can do it. I don't know how they do that. I'm not a scientist. So some of the things are pretty close. Others, it's a matter of taking the dates of the kings of the Israel and Judah. And sometime, just take a beginning and ending date and you sit down and you try to figure. I mean, if you want real frustration in life, that is. I mean, if you want to prove to yourself that you don't know everything, just try to figure out all the kings of Israel and who was with whom and whatever, because some of the dates include a reign with their father, some don't, and I mean, it is a major study in itself. I am quite content. I have spent a major amount of time studying that out and trying to get it. I'm content now that I at least have the dates that are basically acceptable within a year or two of the major scholars and Dr. Hay. Now, Dr. Hay may be one of the major scholars, but I include that because he's one of our scholars and one of their scholars. So, we're ballparking it, but, you know, I feel confident in, or I feel comfortable in using dates because I think it's something you can get into, you know, rather than saying 8th century or 6th century or whatever. I mean, that can be so broad. You can, you know, in the course of 100 years, you get two different people from, you know, placed contemporary when they really weren't. So anyway, those are the dates. The background of the dates that I'm giving you in class come from the latest study that Dr. Hay did, and I know it's within the last 5 years because I got the list from him about 5 years ago. There are a group of men who have periodically gotten together who've worked on these dates. They're working on another most current dating with the current scholarship in archaeology, whatever, and we're trying to come up with that soon. But I know John Cossey and Pastinian has worked with that, Mr. Kaplan and Dr. Hay, when they've been able to get together, and then I think there, Mr. Page helped with it, and there were one or two others that then put these dates together with the modern scholarship. So again, that's the next cycle of that is being done. So if you hear a date that is a year off from what you got here, please don't throw all your notes away. Okay, because most of them will be semi-accurate, just adjust. Listen, when I was in college, the Exodus was 1487, so I have to subtract 44 from everything, you know, all these things I memorized. Now I've kind of re-memorized all that stuff, so, you know, I know it was 1443, and I don't have to kind of subtract it. But there are other things that I memorized based on 1487 that now I've got to, you know, I get this date pops into my mind and say, now, is that the right one, or is that 44 years early? But anyway. But the kingdom of God is not built on dates. But your grade is. Not entirely. I don't know. Some of these dates, I think, are important to be able to know who was when and to correlate them. So we'll get a little bit more tacky on dates. And, of course, the closer you get to now, the more easy it is to know what the dates were, because we do have modern scholarship. We do have history and the annals of Medo-Persian Empire and Alexander the Great and the Roman Empire. Those are much more available than the Assyrian, which they're still trying to dig up in place. You know, eventually we'll probably know as much about the Assyrian as we do the Medo-Persian and Roman and whatever, but they're digging up the tablets and all the records, and then as they translate them, then, you know, we'll know more and more. Well, a lot has been destroyed because of the tales that are lost, but then are there records in many different places that then would, you know, corroborate it? Anyway, we look then at the at Cyrus, 559 to 530. He is the king of Ezra, chapter 1 through chapter 4, verse 5, and then chapter 4, verse 24. Let me turn to Ezra here. Ezra, Nehemiah. There it is, Ezra. So we pick up chapter 1 with the fall of Babylon in 539. The decree of Cyrus says in the first year. So since he took it in 539, if it's in the first year, this could be 539 to 538 in this time frame that he makes this decree. There is a Cyrus cylinder that we have that then shows what this decree was. At one point I had a copy of that. I don't know if I've got that here or not. Anyway, what it simply states is that he gave directives to many religions to go back and to build temples to their gods. Not just to Judaism. Now, some people, I think, have got the mistaken idea that Cyrus was halfway converted and that he believed in the God of Israel, that he was the only God, and that this is a return of monotheism to Cyrus. It is not the case. Cyrus, as we can read in the Cyrus cylinder, was given to wanting peace in the kingdom. There's a certain aspect of syncretism, of allowing cultural diversity. So if you allow the Hindus to have their god, and you allow the Babylonians that are taken captive, and they can go and they can worship Baal, and you allow the Assyrians that are still captive, but they can worship their god, and if Israel can worship Yahweh, then the people are going to be happy. If the people are happy and they're paying their taxes, then Cyrus is happy. It's just like the United States. Now, the United States allows religious pluralism as long as you pay your taxes. Now, as a religion, if you start believing that you don't have to pay taxes, then you become a threat to the constituted government, and then see how long you can stay out of the courts and out of jail. It's the same kind of idea then, although, yes, they still were captive, they were enslaved, they did have to pay, you know, generally much higher taxes than we do. It was not the ease and the freedom of travel. So, you know, I'm not saying that it was just like it is now, but there are some parallels. So he sent Israel back, and he paid for the rebuilding of the temple out of his coffers. This was something that was inspired by God, undoubtedly. We know that Cyrus is a unique individual and that he was prophesied. Isaiah chapter 44 and 45 shows that God prophesied about 100, 150 years before they came on the scene.